to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the accounts payable. That would be the accounts payable from 617 through 621, the amount of $1,022,573.14. Noting that the county, the assistant county manager has reviewed and approved such.
Second.
Discussion?
Items of note, yeah.
Items of note?
There is a large, long list of items of note, as you might imagine, so I'll just review those quickly. So there's a payment to Advocates, which is the HRC second half payment for that agency of $6,610. Alpine Aggregates for $6,552.65 for gravel for County Roads 35A and 20. Rock County Council on Aging, also their HRC allocation for the second half of the year, $11,250. Colorado Division of Fire Prevention and Control, $1,158.94, which is a cost from the Murphy Fire. It's
how much again?
$1,158.94. Okay. Not quite the $300,000 you might be thinking.
No, I'm good. Yeah, we're good.
I just noted it because it was Murphy Fire cost, and it's essentially the cost for a brush truck to come up upon request from the fire suppression fund. Correctional health care companies, $11,539.98, which is detention center health care, some monthly medical services at the jail. Integrated community, $6,000 from HRC, second half contribution. Duckles Construction, this is a large one, for $340,304.25. It's the Green Truss Bridge replacement, 30% payment. Kilgore Companies, this is for $10,946.06 for gravel, County Road 62 and 209. Grand Futures, HRC payment for the second half of $3,750. Lift Up of Route County, HRC payment of $5,000. Northwest Colorado Visiting Nurses Doing Business at Northwest Colorado Health, HRC payment of $12,500. Precision Excavating, $41,481.63, which is gravel for County Roads 44, 80, 46, and 37. Planned Parenthood, $3,750 from HRC second half payment. Partners in Route County, $15,440. That's a combination of HRC payment, which is $5,440, and $10,000 from TANF. Search and Rescue, Route County Search and Rescue, this is second half payments from Public Safety. This is $20,350. Rocky Mountain Youth Corps, combination of HRC and TANF, $11,000 in total, $6,000 from HRC and $5,000 from TANF for the second half of the year. Steamboat Architectural Associates, $2,400. This is from the building and plant pool for drawings for DHS building security upgrades.
How much was that?
$2,400. The Colorado West Regional Mental Health Incorporated, doing business as Mind Springs Health. That's HRC payment of $7,500. And yes, there's more. Totally Kids, $5,000 HRC payment. Route County United Way, HRC and TANF payment of $15,750. $12,000 of that is TANF, $3,750 for HRC. The Yampa Valley Autism Program, $3,500 from HRC. Sirocco Baseball and Softball, $2,500 from HRC. Resource X, or Exploration LLC, $30,000 from the BCC, which is for priority-based budgeting, annual subscription, and half of that is reimbursed through DOLA. The Slate Communications invoice for the month, which is $2,563 from the BCC Communications. Bear Communications, Inc. They are getting payment out of a communications pool of $26,096.60 for the comm center move. Little Lambs, LLC. This is payment from First Impressions of $15,000 for Little Lambs daycare startup expenses. Mm-hmm. And last but not least, Ulrich Salzgeber, which is actually, I think, the Board of Realtors, but for some reason was paid to Ulrich, $1,000 from Community Services for the 2019 Wildfire Conference. That was payment that was authorized by the board.
What was the $217,000 to the GMCO Corp?
That's our, not chip seal, but the Magclora.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
GMCO.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
So the question on the working kids, what is that?
Totally Kids.
Totally Kids.
No, the Gretchen Van de Kar,
Rocky Mountain Youth Corps.
Rocky Mountain Youth Corps. And you said half of that was TANF? So
it's
that
5,000 TANF,
6,000. So is that something that's income eligibility that we follow up on as well, I assume?
That it was on that list that Kelly brought us. Remember, she had a list of four organizations she was going to send the extra TANF money to that it didn't go back to the state, and that was one that was listed. Yeah. And I think she did say they can distribute it based on percentage of kids that are income eligible.
So there has to be some eligible kids there to free up to do that.
Right. I'd have to go back to her email, but she did tell us that.
Yeah. Okay. We're good.
Okay. All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. So we had a work session yesterday with updates from the county manager, legal, the Yampa Valley Regional Airport, environmental health, the clerk and recorder, public health, the planning department, and human services.
I'm going to need a
resolution. Hey, I have a question about that. So it looks like I made a mistake last time. And we marked it with the wrong number.
Yeah,
do we have to do anything to fix that, or
we took care of that.
Just taken care of?
Yeah.
Okay. I just didn't notice this column.
What's my number?
You've never made a mistake,
really?
As far as I know. I shouldn't already believe
this. This is the first one.
Okay.
I've made mistakes, but I don't admit to them. So that
045. 045.
Okay. Madam Chair, move to approve consent agenda items A, B, C, and D. Noting that item D will be resolution number 2019-045.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Any questions on that resolution? Does it make sense what we're doing?
Which resolution is
that? The granary one.
The granary.
Oh, no. Yeah, no.
Okay.
You know, it's damn confusing. I don't know.
Thank you.
I think we got it.
Yeah, we got it.
Introduce yourself for the record. That would be great. And then just tell us what you've got to tell us.
Okay. Hey, good morning. My name is Tara Humphries. I'm the district ranger with the U.S. Forest Service Hans Peak Bears Ranger District. Thanks for allowing me a spot of time to come and visit with you. I thought what I could do is I'm trying to get at least biannual visits with you guys, if not quarterly, just to let you know what's happening. So big picture, of course, we're trying to transition from winter season to summer season with all of our programs.
Trying, being a key word, right?
As the weather will permit. So I thought I'd just share with you some of what's happening in our programs, and we could visit about questions unless you guys have a... Okay.
That sounds great.
Great. So overall, as an agency, from the national and the regional priorities that have been established, our priorities remain timber, fuels, and we've had a third priority added for us for 2019, and that's trails maintenance target. And that target is specifically in this region, and it's centered around much of the dead and down component that we have throughout the forests of this region. you may have seen some stuff about our regional forester allowing and then revoking saw use in some of the wilderness areas, just of interest. That wasn't something that we wanted to do here with the Zirgo Wilderness, so we didn't. But there is a regional emphasis on getting some of these trails cleared.
So the regional forester has the authority to waive the rule about mechanical devices in the wilderness area?
On a very temporarily basis. We have it in an emergency situation, but this was a very temporary, short-term, sort of a one-off to meet some work needs. And then, however, it wasn't particularly well-received, and due to the snow that we had, it wasn't really applicable, so...
Didn't matter. Mother Nature stepped in.
Yeah, so we opted not for that. So we'll just kind of track down a list with our priority, national priority work. Our timber program is targeted at 140,000 CCF forest-wide for the Medicine Bow route. Here on Hans Peak Bears Ears, we have about 8 active timber sales in various stages of layout to reforestation on the backside of those timber sales. They're happening up towards Little Red Park, Seed House, various other places. I think you're familiar with those. We're really excited to be still executing our Good Neighbor Authority with the state of Colorado and the Steamboat Front project. That is a timber and fuels project. Thus far, we've got about 900 acres of mechanical fuels target with that project for 2019. We had hoped to do some burning around that project. We had about a two-day window where we went from no snow to green up, so that really curtailed our prescribed fire burn windows this year. So as far as spring windows, that doesn't mean we're out for fall windows, but we'll have to take a
look. Do you have like an arbitrary cutoff date regardless of conditions?
We don't necessarily, no.
So what's the problem even now with a controlled burn?
So the burns that we were trying to do were in a brush fuel component. So with that green grass understory, we likely wouldn't get fire to carry and have a very meaningful outcome that met our objectives.
Yeah, well, I get that.
Yeah.
Same thing when we're burning ditches.
Yeah.
And once the green stuff comes up, we can hardly do it.
Yeah, so that's where we had that short kind of no snow transition to Emerald Isle, I guess. But our fire program continues to subscribe to the National Cohesive Wildland Fire National Cohesive Management Strategy, restore and maintain landscape, support fire adapted communities, and provide response to wildland fire. To that end, we'll have our wildland fire modules, Storm Peak Fire Module, here in Steamboat out of this office at this time. They're on the San Juan National Forest, helping them with some prescribed burning because they are in a little bit different weather climatological regime, as you know, so they have some conditions that will allow for burning. Other pieces of wildland fire equipment, engines and such, will be located in parks in Yamba. Same complement as resources that you've seen in the past from us. We're continuing to engage in a number of projects around wildland fire, Route County mitigation planning. We are working with all our interagency partners out of the Craig Dispatch Center to update the Interagency National Fire Danger Operating Plan. If you're not familiar with that particular product, you may be familiar with one of the outcomes of that product, and that's Smokey's Arm. So that allows us to make an assessment of fire danger several different ways, some of which is for public in terms of that.
Smokey should be going back up at the cleft shortly, right, Tom? Smokey the
Bear
should be going up pretty shortly at the cleft.
I didn't know we had a Smokey.
Yeah, we've had this
one. It had to be taken down.
Always been at the project.
Got it.
Yeah.
So who goes out and physically turns the arm?
It depends on who's hosting the Smokey.
Okay.
So. Usually our firefighters, though, or firefighters that we work with in terms of the...
But the one at the cleft will be our sheriff or somebody like... Okay.
Yeah. Either your sheriff or your firefighter. Complete detour. Side notes, Smokey will also be going up in another capacity around the July 12th, the Balloon Festival. We'll have Smokey the Bear there, so he'll be there.
Flying?
Yeah.
Smokey's going to fly?
He does.
There's a balloon, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a Smokey balloon.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought you stuck him in the basket or something.
No.
Hey, meaning from the basket.
With a fire hose.
With a fire hose, right?
I think the other thing of note is that we continue to work with the city and Mount Warner around their CWP squared project, which is a critical community watershed protection plan. So we'll continue to do that work as that evolves towards wrapping up the planning part of that.
We heard yesterday from our environmental health director that the focus was shifting from prevention to response. And that group, does that square with what you think is going on?
Yeah, so a majority of the conversations that we had around that project is the upper levels of that watershed sit in predominantly spruce up there, spruce fir ecosystem. That's a very binary on-off ecosystem, and when I say that, it tends to either host very low fire behavior, or it's at the other end of the spectrum of very high fire behavior. So those sorts of treatments and where we are with our fuels and our climate, as we've seen evidenced by the larger fires that we've had in recent years, mitigations such as fuel breaks don't tend to have a huge effect. Those fuel types, when they're burning typically with higher intensities. They're crown fighters. They have very long-range spotting distances associated with them, and for that reason, fuel breaks are not extremely effective, and we would really look towards implementing strategies that would have a high probability of success up there in terms of mitigation. We don't believe that there's lots to be done up there. There is a little bit of work potentially to be done as far as vegetation manipulation and mitigation around the sanctuary, possibly. We looked at some of those areas, but you're absolutely right. We looked towards more towards the front side and the back side as far as education and outreach around people and visitors knowing that that is our watershed. We do garner our water source from there. And then on the back side with the water treatment plant and redundancy in the system at large. So I think that's really where that process drove us to. I think some other not as daylighted outcomes of that, my experiences, I was just thinking, it wasn't last year, I was on the 416 fire around this time. The fact that the group has been aggregated and aligned and has those relations in place is hugely beneficial now that we're further down the planning path if we do have an event that would precipitate some sort of emergency action. So we can't say enough about how groups function once they have these relationships in place. So that is a huge benefit. We were also able to identify some data needs that the Forest Service, the Weather Service, and NRCS might be able to do in the watershed so that we have some idea at least what baseline norm conditions are and what allows them to extrapolate in terms of a fire, what the effects might be to the water
for
the city.
So, thank you.
Yeah, that's been a fun project.
Right.
Yeah, we look forward to the end result. I mean, we're helping participate in the roundtable, ended up putting a bunch of money into it too. So,
yeah.
And again, I think the collaboration process and then, you know, even down to the sanctuary, that's really below the watershed anyhow. I mean, if you're down to there, we're already past the water pump station anyhow. So,
yeah, and it was really good, just good to visit around some, like I said, alternatives and probability of success and really what the expected outcome might be and what the reality of what that outcome would likely be. So we'll continue to stay involved with that. On a positive note around fire season, though,
you mean the rain?
it's really wet, and it's not fire season yet. July 1st, that's next week. I don't even think it's going to be.
Our National Interagency Coordination Center is predicting significant wildfire forecast of significant wildfire outcome potential. Their forecast is below to normal through the month of September. That can change, but it's...
Except who knows what normal is anymore.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So I think that's kind of the wrap-up around fire. As we transition into recreation, I think it's been tough for both our field crews and the public. Everyone's angsty to get into the field and start all the work that we do on the trails and our developed rec sites, and the public is anxious to get back there as well, especially with the impending 4th of July holiday, and we absolutely realize that. The concern on our part is for resource damage with the wet conditions, as well as a handful of other issues that come along with the residual snowpack and moisture that we've had. So we'll continue to monitor that situation and hopefully get folks out into the woods as well as our crews. July 18th, we still have 78 inches of snow at Buck Pass. So, June 18th. Yeah, thanks, Tim. In other news, Mad Rabbit And we are hoping to have another preliminary proposal out by the end of the month. That proposal incorporates conversation that we had at the Mount Mad Rabbit roundtable. We're looking forward to transitioning into the Route Recreation Roundtable for a longer-term strategic look at recreation. So we're happy to be engaged in that process and thank everybody who's a part of that and the city for supporting and convening that.
So there's going to be a proposed plan of action from the Forest Service.
Be a preliminary proposal. It won't go into the formal scoping project quite yet. I want to take one more pause to take some of that good feedback that was provided, wrap that in, let people get a sense of it, and then the overall plan is to sort of walk that at the end of the month. We would have some time to do the proposal. Our specialists would wrap up some build work this summer and hopefully have an environmental analysis towards the end of the winter.
And how long does an EA take?
And have you guys decided to do an EA or an EIS? Have you guys decided that?
So, no, we haven't decided that. Yeah. The analysis itself will drive that. We can't will or pay for a different level of analysis. The level of analysis is commensurate with the law, and that is the path that we will go. I would be remiss not to say that in aligning with some of our partners, there are actions that we know that would that would propel us towards an EIS, and in the choice to be aligned with our partners, those are actions that we are not taking. So from this point, we'll see where the analysis takes us, and if it drives us to an EIS, then it does, and that's another conversation point with our partners around that project about what we do.
So is that decision-making process around whether to do an EA or an EIS, it's like you said, it's driven by the law. Mm-hmm. But then there's the question of how it gets paid for. And so I guess it's been our understanding, or it's been my understanding, I should say, that the city of Steamboat would actually be contributing money to help pay for an EA or an EIS. And I was a little surprised by that. I thought if you guys did an EA or an EIS, you just did it with your own resources.
No, the arrangement around that is that the city is paying for the planning process.
And does any applicant or whatever, yes.
Yeah, and like I said, if we get to an EIS, that's certainly another pause point to have a conversation and with the partners decide what that looks like.
What are the considerations in the law for an EA versus an EIS? What do they look at? What does the law say?
If you're going to have significant impact,
and there's just a way of measuring what or analyzing what
there's
significant
several
impact is.
Conditions around there depending on the program area. And,
yep.
So
and you make that decision and it gets signed off by the district forest ranger, right? I mean
she is
your boss.
Yes. I have the authority to sign EAs and categorical exclusions and environmental assessments. EIS is a different level of authority. So all of this is done in alignment with the agency for the most part.
I'm hearing from you that you don't feel like this is a subjective process, that there's an objective way to determine whether or not it's an EA or an EIS.
I think there is. I think there's a bit of rigor, and there's definitely a law around it. And okay. Like I said, that is the analysis will be compliant with the law, and that is...
It's just the way it is.
That is the choice we have.
That's helpful to understand.
And then if you don't like it, then you get to go appeal it to the courts. You know?
So yeah.
That's helpful to understand because there's definitely been some conversation that makes it sound like it's just a decision point.
Yeah, you know, can't really buy or will a different level of analysis.
Yeah.
Understand, of course, that let's just say, for instance, that you objectively determine that it should be an EA instead of an EIS, there will be a number of people that will second-guess that decision.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And that is the wonderful thing about NEPA is there are several points for public involvement as the law defined and set forth.
So that's very diplomatic of you.
Well, I mean, she's just following procedure
absolutely.
From her perspective, so that's great. Objective is better than subjective, unless depending on your perspective.
Yeah, so that's where we are with Mad Rabbit. Other than that, we're really excited about, like I said, getting out onto the trails and doing work with Friends of Wilderness.
I'm sorry, just one more thing.
Sure, yeah, we can.
If this project moves forward, and my guess is that this project will move forward at some level or another, would the applicant, or is the city of Steamboat Springs the applicant, and is it the city of Steamboat Springs that would be actually the one building the trails, or would it be the Forest Service that's driving it and being the one to build the trails?
Right, so it's a little bit of complex and unwieldy, even for me as the new ranger, to wrap my head about not being here at the founding of this process. However, it will be a combination. So in terms of we'll build some of the trails that were not identified in the Steamboat Trails Alliance or don't have a proxy in this process, and then we will likely do a bid for a contract to build out the other trails. We'll work with our partners and define exactly how that looks, but I'm pretty sure the city doesn't have a trail building component. So
that's interesting. If I hear you right, there's the 2A group and the 2A trails money. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be building some trails. But as part of this process, the Forest Service is taking it upon themselves to add to what 2A wants to do?
Yes.
Okay.
We are, because we're looking at a big footprint.
Okay.
To look at recreation holistically in terms of trails.
And then
I think
you got
a bit remiss not to.
You have budget for this. For the part that the Forest Service would do? Or are you going to be taking some money from 2A into the Forest Service and then using that money to build some trails?
I do not have a budget line item to build the trails that come out of this. You know, my budget is given to me annually, and so I cannot foretell what the future will hold.
Okay. But it sounds to me like presumably you'll be making a budget request for that component.
We will. And having the planning completed allows us to potentially lever other funding sources as well.
Okay. And then presumably, or maybe hopefully, included in that will be maintenance and enforcement ongoing costs that you'll be able to budget for on a sustainable basis.
Yeah, for the most part, in conjunction with the two endowment funds, the Trails Endowment Fund and the Wild Fund, although we understand that those probably won't be the sole provider even at maturity, and the rates of the maturity of the two are different right now. But yeah, we do understand the maintenance and the enforcement component
okay. That
goes along with the
But I mean, that's always been a struggle for you guys. I mean, you know, we hear and understand that the Route Medicine Bow has one law enforcement officer.
True.
And is there some thought that that would expand, especially in light of new trail development? I'm sorry to ask you such tough questions.
No, it's
she don't know you yet.
And I can accept that answer.
It's. I was going to say, Tim, I'm not super familiar. It's interesting how the U.S. Forest Service works because we have our National Forest Service lands and then we have law enforcement, which is a different silo. And so I don't have any particular projections. My gut says, without going on too much of a limb, that they're not going to get any windfall of dollars in the near future for a law enforcement capacity increasement.
So I guess I would just express an opinion then that it seems to me that if the Forest Service is going to be developing more trails and incentivizing more and more people to use the backcountry, that there ought to be a commensurate increase in law enforcement. That's my opinion.
Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome.
Noted.
We could just send the sheriff up there that much more. You
know? Yeah, right. So, I'm sure that would
be trail riders.
Okay. They probably like that, Doug.
They probably do.
Sure they would, yeah. Well, in fact, they do, yes.
Yeah. Okay, we're done beating you up over Mad Rabbit.
That's okay. This is a good time to visit about it.
No, it's good.
Okay.
Well, and again, we're having some discussions here at the local level, trying to figure out how we're going to mitigate the impacts to our resources as well, so which are not funded either. So,
yeah, and
trying to figure out how and what that happens, what that looks like, or whether we're just SOL, and
the poster child for that, Doug can talk about it, is out there on the other side of Emerald Mountain, which was BLM, not Forest Service. But you know what we're talking about over
there? I do. I have heard about this scenario.
Okay.
But yes, we are trying to be very cognizant and consider the impacts to the high density recreation areas that seem to affect your roads. I think that's where we most have an interaction that we have a tough time reconciling on both sides of the fence.
Yep. So.
Absolutely.
So, we'll get out there and maintain the trails that we do have. Again, we're looking forward to our partners. We have Friends of Wilderness, Rocky Mountain Youth Corps we've hired on to do lots of work with us. Mountain Trails Access, the motorized group, looking forward to working with them. We're also looking forward to engage more in an Adopt-a-Trail program with Route County Riders and some other folks as far as a trail maintenance support. And I think that's really all I have to visit about REC. Again, the lower elevation sites are starting to open, and we'll just keep opening as weather permits. Range. Our program continues to support 60 allotments, 25 permittees, 30,000 sheep, and 2,500 cows. They are also facing some difficulties with the weather as far as getting in and fixing fences, and we're fast approaching on dates for those permittees, so they're looking forward
to. There's no grass there.
To get engaged.
they just got it out from underneath snow.
So, we'll look towards helping those folks get on as soon as they can and get their fences repaired. I'm assuming with all the snow, most of what I've seen in the high country with a lot of snow, we have some downed trees on fence lines and stuff like that. So we'll support those folks in getting their operations geared up and going. Our range program is also working with Brown County Weeds Program, continuing our noxious weeds.
Thank you.
An invasive program, so we're looking forward to that. Transitioning to lands and realty. This has been one of our most busy program areas lately. There's two main things that have come across our desk as far as walk-in business that have taken a fair amount of time. The WAPA, Western Association of Power Administration.
Yep.
As well as YVEA have been interested in doing maintenance in pretty short order. My assumption is some of that around the campfire and PG&E.
We want them to do the wildland fire mitigation to protect their critical resources, too.
Exactly, and that's what they're looking to do.
Yep.
So we've been trying to process those requests in short order and get those folks ready to implement this summer. WAPA wants to implement this summer.
So they need to specifically ask for permission from the Forest Service to go up and clear out around their power lines?
They do. They have a permit and a right-of-way, which enables them to do mitigation for a wildfire without much process, but it's just a conversation that we need to have about what they're looking to do. And I think they were interested in potentially just understanding what the scope of what they could do and could not do. And so our regional office has been working with a number of electrical providers and that. The other thing that has come in is Colorado Division of Water, Division 6, sent out a notice requiring installation of head gates and measuring devices.
Oh, yeah, we know all about it.
So we're working with them to try to figure out how most succinctly and effective to implement that. That affects about...
On Forest Service lands.
On Forest Service lands, yes.
Through the permits that were there or whatever.
Exactly. We have about around 53 diversions, we think, that we need to do some sort of permitting for. We're really just trying to wrap our arms around that.
Just in the Hot Speak Bears areas, or does that include the Yampa?
It's the entire Yampa River Basin. So that is the south zone at large. So that's...
So it includes parts of the Yampa Ranger District.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested. So if I had a head gate, say, up the Bear River, actually, I do have a head gate up the Bear, but if I had a head gate up the Bear River that was on Forest Service property, I don't automatically have a right to just drive up there with my backhoe and do the work that I need to do.
I don't know. I don't have one.
I guess, I mean,
I have one of those. I think you do have some prescriptive rights. But sure. And again, some of those ditches were before the Forest Service, the land was even reserved for the Forest Service. So
yeah, and I would refrain getting into it.
And we have some, like the Upper Yemp, we have some that are and some that aren't, and some are there after the reservation. And so, yeah.
Yeah, there's several different types of water rights, and depending on what needs to be done there.
These guys don't necessarily have a right to just go up and start digging and doing what they need to do.
Right.
Okay.
In some cases that may be the path, depending on how, what, when, where, but there's a handful of different situations that we're working through.
Yeah, I bet there is.
So these are these headgates that need to be installed. These are all private or some of the, or you all have some as well?
No, they're all,
they're all private.
Yeah,
they're okay.
Different. And again, it's not only, so you have to have a head gate and a measuring device.
Right.
So
it's
the
two
both of those there.
So
exactly.
Sometimes
and they are.
One or the other or both.
And, yeah, and, I remember Aaron talking about it.
Yeah, and there's no question that many of them are really in rough condition.
Yeah.
I mean, they need to be fixed. And actually, if it's done correctly, I mean, the good news is if these guys go up and build a really good structure, and get it right one time, then there'll be years that they don't need to be going running back and forth and digging and diverting. You know, they'll have a decent structure.
Yeah, I'm not intimately familiar with measuring devices and head gates, so I'll take your word for it, Tim.
Well, it's true. You build one really decent, because a lot of the times these guys go up with, you know, big rocks, and they're moving dirt around with a backhoe to try to get the water into the ditch, and so there's resource damage that takes place while they're trying to do that. They build a nice concrete headgate, then all they have to do is go out and put boards in and take them out to control the water.
It's no different than if your headgate was coming out of somebody else's private property.
Right.
You wouldn't want them to just go out there and dozing around on your property either.
And so that's what they used to do on my property until they came in and built a decent headgate for the bird ditch. It was really nice. Yeah. Once it was done, they stopped trashing my property.
Well, that's a good thing. We'll hope for a different outcome with ours. And so that's been a lot of critical work in short order for that department, and that has been their focus, and I think that needs to be the focus. So there's been a whole host of other projects that have continued or materialized on the district. We're going to continue with the Silver Fire burned area emergency rehabilitation. That project continues on with our hydrology and fire and soils folks. We are replacing the Hans Pete lookout windows and repairing the damage that was done due to vandalism after we recently restored that. So that was a bit of a sad go, but we'll hope to get up there in August and get that fixed. We are continuing to work with our CMC intern program this summer. We have a handful of those folks, so that's exciting and fun to have that energy around the office. Again, continuing supporting and appreciating Yamptica for all the education and outreach that they do. Our fish program is continuing with the Burgess Creek, their native trout reclamation. They're in year 4 of that project.
So that's where some threatened trout species were identified right there at the ski area?
Yeah, right in the neighborhood through there. And so they'll keep working on that reclamation project. This is year 4. All indicators are that's going well. So.
Yeah, that was kind of a surprise, I think.
Yeah, it was. I'm surprised that they would want to hang out there. That doesn't seem like their ideal location.
I mean, it was kind of just above all the work, I think, that they did at the when they daylighted Burgess Creek.
All that and the stuff. Little beach and the
So I think my impression is it was somewhere just above that they identified this fairly rare strain of trout.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And so you must work with CPW on that, or is
our fish biologist does? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the botany program can hopefully wrap up their rabbit ears Gilead conservation plan. It's not a threatened endangered species, but we're working on some management around that species. There's a whole host of other projects going on that we could visit about, and if you guys want to visit about anything more or in particular, it'd be
so I have one
happy
a little bit. So I've always been curious about the relationship between the Hans Peak district and the Yampa district. I mean, do you guys supervise the Yampa district in any way, or are you just two separate entities?
So we do not supervise the Yampa Ranger District. We have six districts under the Medicine Bow Route Thunder Basin, three of which are on the Route National Forest, and that is Parks, Hans Peak Bear Reserves, and then the Yampa, of course. And so really, we found efficiency working as a zone. There's many of our programs that we have zoned, but we all three have independent rangers for our program and for our footprint.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe this question isn't relevant to you, but certainly relevant to Ray, who's our public works director.
How are you? I didn't see you.
Have you guys met?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So we have a group of people that are, and I spoke to them this morning, that are going to be sending a letter to you requesting OHV access up our County Road 25 out of Oak Creek up to the Forest Service boundary. And there's a short section of Forest Service Road that these people had been in discussion with Basha Trout before she left
right.
about opening up that section of road for OHV traffic. And so I'm wondering if you have any input into that or if that's just a Yampa Ranger District issue.
That is a Yampa Ranger District project. Since Basha left, we have not permanently been able to fill that position. We are having hiring struggles within our agency, to say the least. So we've had temporary acting rangers in there for a period of 120 days. Matthias Wallace just started. He comes to us from the East Coast, and he just started Monday, so give him a few days before you ask him about that.
Well, it'll be the other folks that'll go.
Well, the bottom line, they're allowed in the Forest Service anyhow, so really, I mean...
This section of road is a closed section of road.
It's for ATVs or closed, period?
Closed for ATVs, I think. Yeah, you can walk it.
Do you have those that are closed for ATVs?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Even though they're open for highway traffic?
No, this isn't open for highway traffic.
So it's not open for anything?
Yeah,
it's just open for foot traffic or bicycle traffic.
Oh, okay.
But that's it.
Well, that makes a whole bunch of difference.
Right.
Yeah. Makes a whole bunch of difference for us opening up 25, and so you don't get to go anywhere.
That's what I told them very specifically. Absolutely. They needed to give Ray a letter making a request, but I told them in the long term there was probably no way that we would consent to open up 25 if it didn't actually connect on up to Dunkley.
I mean, that's the only reason we opened up the one road we opened up.
Exactly.
Was because it was a
connector.
Dead end between two forest roads that were being used.
Yeah.
And the rest, we opened up that one road.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's Tim Geiger. I made it clear to him that,
yeah, no, I,
that
I
there
was
no
way
we were going to move forward if that didn't happen first.
Yeah.
And no guarantees that we would move forward under any set of circumstances.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not familiar with that
okay.
one.
Okay.
So we had the CMC, some of the CMC folks in here, and there was one that was talking about looking at the campsites up at Buff Pass, and I don't remember his name, but he had been evaluating the impact and kind of recommending some management up there about how to fix the mess that's happening, and I'm just curious if you guys have any plans to proceed with anything this summer, if that's kind of, he was just evaluating it, if it's a long-term project. What are you looking at in terms of management up there?
Yeah, so in short-term, a couple of things are happening. We will put the Dry Lake Campground redesign. We've got about a 60% design now, so we'll hopefully get that bid out and built out next summer. Not this summer, but the next summer.
And is that what he was working on?
He was probably working on an inventory of dispersed sites.
I think that is, yeah. I think that's actually
so
it.
So there's a couple of factors that play into that. One, of course, is the Dry Lake campground and parking lot redesign. The second piece is we are in the process of the planning process of doing some not road upgrades, but merely bringing that road to standard. It's a level 3 road, so there's a handful of miles that need various things, whether it's some rock and gravel, whether it's making the appropriate size safety turnouts and two-lane. Not immensely different, but really just bringing that road to the standard it should be. So when we do that, that could, of course, encourage more traffic, either to go towards the Yampa side
or to designate camp up there and disperse some of that. Regardless,
you mean the North Park side?
Yeah, the North Park side. Yeah, regardless, the three ranger districts are looking at dispersed camping as a whole. The park side is feeling some overflow from the Arapahoe Roosevelt. We know that we're busy here, so we are looking at how we would like to approach dispersed camp planning. And we're really just in the infancy. We've clearly identified it, articulated, and we're at the where do we go from here stage. So collecting that data is helping us drive towards a plan.
And the Dry Lake campground redesign is happening when?
Assuming that the bidding process goes successful, mm-hmm. Not this summer, but the next summer. Mm-hmm.
And then construction, when?
That next summer.
Oh.
So would it be closed for that summer, or what do you do?
2020 construction.
Yeah, yep. It would likely have to be partially closed. We'll see how the bid comes in, if one group takes it all, or if we just do the campground, and then to be determined, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So our former commissioner, Ben Bell, met with Doug last week.
Yeah. And me too, Doug. I bet you guys heard the same story.
And me too.
Oh, and you too.
And I met with him on Friday, and he has these...
I'm really left out.
Sorry about that.
You'll get yours.
Don't worry.
Oh, I spent plenty of time with Ben, but he didn't meet me with me about this.
Okay, so he's pushing this, his concept. He's got a name for it, which is demand management, which, you know, kind of echoes the water thing, about how to find a way to communicate to our citizens and our visitors, especially in the wintertime, that there's no point in driving up to the Dry Lake campground. Do you have any ideas or thoughts about that?
Yeah, we discuss, and we have a handful of solutions, both in the short term more tactically, and in the long term more strategically. And I think in the short term, we're completely supportive of Strawberry Park residents, the hot springs, and the city, and some of the other folks that Ben was working and convening with as far as signage and some of those bits and pieces. I think there's other solutions as far as a web presence, whatever scale
that he's pushing. Well,
yeah, the web presence. We also talked about, we were discussing a more simplistic sign concept. We talked about a larger sign concept that could be more like the Colorado DOT signs where you see where you can change on and parking lot is full and that sort of thing versus
more the sign
concept. We've talked about remote cameras off there. We've talked about everything from a hotline to a website that deals with all the recreation. So if your favorite spot is occupied, then you could maybe choose to go to Dunkley versus Buff Pass, choose to go to North Row versus Muddy and Rabbit Ears. So we've talked about a handful of solutions. I think we're supportive of them all. I've encouraged him to take this to the Route Recreation Roundtable. I think that would be an awesome first foray to get some input and some thoughts around that. I'm completely confident that group of people has more skills and knowledge and creativity towards solutions than any one of us independently. And so we'll be supportive of where he wants to go in the short term. And in the long term, I think the Route Recreation Roundtable could help us.
So short of that alternative, I mean, we still have the alternative for us to get together, for, you know, one or so of us, one of you and us, and Road and Ridge is coming, you know, and I guess the other stakeholders who come up with a process to move it forward, too, other than, I mean, it's a little different than the Recreation Roundtable or the what you're talking about. And again, I don't know, we're all... You're looking for your resources. We're trying to protect our resources and trying to figure out
sure.
the level of services that we provide. And I think we're all in agreement. We don't need to send a million people up there. So the one experience in Steamboat Springs, around Steamboat Springs, was a bad experience.
Yeah.
So we need to get to figure out how to do that. So if we need to figure out how collectively we need to convene a group that, you know, policymakers that we can do. I appreciate the group having their input on it as well, but we still run
the resources. We're the ones that are going to have to pay for it.
Exactly. We're the ones that run the resources that are going to be part of it. So, yeah. So.
And as I shared with Ben, I'm happy to engage, however, because we certainly want to do our part around our recreation experiences and supporting the public, whether it be residents or not.
We appreciate your leadership and getting, I think you were pretty instrumental in getting the recreation roundtable going, the concept of taking a bigger look at recreation throughout Rock County. So that's great. And I know, I'm sure I'm speaking for these, I really appreciate you taking the time to come here and talk to us. I mean, I learned in 30 minutes, I learned a lot that I needed to know. So thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah. Please feel free to reach out if you have any questions. We have lots going on.
So what are we doing about 550?
There you go. Thanks.
When's it going to open? Is that your question?
No.
Next winter.
The winter discussion.
There's no problem.
Do you want to come up, Ray?
Come on up, Ray.
Come on up. Come on up.
So, and again,
you want to see the whites of her eyes.
Come on, Ray.
We're all kind of stuck in a bind here a little bit. I mean,
me as well.
Yeah, no, I understand that. That's what I'm saying too. And, you know, we kind of agreed. Well, we'd get some gravel out of there. We would help with the, you know, we got some gravel resources. Maybe we'll put the crusher up there and get some gravel resources out on the road and on 129 and on up for there too. And we did kind of make some type of commitment at one point in time.
Some sort of
of course, we could always say that was a different set of commissioners, you know. And we never make them.
I don't know any of those guys.
We don't make any commitments for life, you know.
Yeah, that's
situations
right.
Have changed. But anyhow, we do kind of want to figure out, you know, and, you know, at that point in time, and again, I'm old as the dirt anyhow, but it was still part of here when we were working on trying to get the traffic off for 129 above Hans Peak and trying to get them out onto the forest and the rest of the snowmobile traffic and trying to not to have them run through Hans Peak and all that stuff that we did all that through that time. And we still support this dispersed snowmobile traffic too, and we know that we're going to continue to get more and more of that as Rabbiters continues to be full, Buff Pass, Dry Lake going to continue being full, and the rest. Well, the next overflow places, you just automatically drive another 30 minutes or 40 minutes somewhere up to 550 and park up there. And again, I guess we need to collectively figure out how that's going to move forward. We got blindsided by the thing, but the snowmobile club kind of said, well, you guys promised to plow that out when it was done and ready, and now it's done and ready, so how come you guys aren't going to go plow it out? So then Ray's new, and said, well, and then, so said, well, really, and then trying to figure out for Ray and his department the logistics of trying to get somebody up there and be able to do that last little bit, and already we got two guys up there doing two full days. I mean, a full day of snow plowing to do their route, just adding on that amount of snow plowing that they need to do for that place.
The road and the parking lot.
It's 550 even open yet? It wasn't a couple weeks ago. It wouldn't even close. So that's kind of one of the challenges that we see if we do try to keep it open. The snowmobilers are going to be cut off sooner getting up high because they won't be able to run that road. And so is it better to have it snowpacked? And of course, the one thing I'm not aware of, the couple of times I've been up there last winter just to look at the situation, it was midweek, of course.
Yes.
So I wouldn't do it on the weekend. But I don't know how much overflow the current parking lot is. So how much is it just something that's there so we have to open it? Or is it better just to use it during the summer? Because then, if we're gonna maintain it, it's really a front end loader type thing. It's not a loader grader, it's not a plow truck, so it's a front end loader. Well, to road the front end loader up there whenever you need it, we're basically talking about leaving one up in North Route, which then takes one away from one of our shops. But the reason I'm interested is because we have some front end loaders that are coming due for replacement, so then do we do a deferred replacement and see how it works out for a winter or two with leaving one out there.
Outside?
Well, we would. I don't know if we would take it clear down to Clark and plug it in there or something. Or
I mean, that's a problem.
We could still park it outside at the, the fire station.
At the fire station.
As long as we have power. We still have, I mean, that's our bay there, which has road motor grader in it, right?
Right.
Say that again?
We have a bay up there at the fire station.
I did not know that.
Oh, you didn't know
that's
that?
Our bay?
Yeah, we paid it. Oh. He's the new president of the Congress.
I don't know about the president, but he's a member of the board, of the two-member board, I think.
I did not.
Two-member board.
Well, I talked to him.
So when that fire station got built, we built a bay.
He said, here. You're a board.
And how big of a bay?
What can
you park in there? A grader?
Yeah, so.
Yeah, so we've got power there.
And you can get a grader inside? Can you get anything else inside?
I don't know. I think it's 30 feet by email, so I don't have to get up there.
Our one bay is 30 feet deep.
I want to go up there and see that someday.
Yeah, so I think it's the middle bay.
Got
it. Well, maybe.
Do you want to add anything about 550, Tara?
No, she was hoping that she could just sneak out the door.
Well, I don't know what the solution is either, right?
And yeah,
again, you know, what we came up with for this agreement back 15 years ago doesn't necessarily mean what we need to do. And I don't know. And again, I guess what we're all trying to head for is some predictability up there for them and you and us.
Yeah.
And so, and safety, of course, and you know, and the consumer. You know, pleasant consumer as well. So, but anyhow,
yeah, I think that is definitely the ask, and we've tried to work through a handful of solutions with the snow club up there, as far as getting a grant for a piece of equipment to leave up there. Maybe we just need to have some more dialogue around what the options are, because we didn't realize that potentially there was a piece of equipment that had some deferment around it. But so we were just looking at ways to leverage whatever we could, because. I don't have an eloquent solution for that problem. I really don't. We have worked with the club. We've visited with you guys. I'm just trying to figure out how that could, should, might work. Does an operator come with it and fuel?
Well, it could.
You get a grant, Rails.
If you can provide the money, we'll take care of the rest.
Oh, is that how this works?
Easy enough.
Good idea.
So Doug and Ray, I don't know if that's more conversation at a later date, but there is definitely an ask from the community up there to have some resolution by this winter.
So, and we're struggling, and I don't go up there that often. I mean, I don't think Ray does either, but we're still struggling. How dire is the need to have that parking lot open?
Yeah.
So my understanding is that there is definitely a need from it, and that precipitated the ask. Besides the conflicting uses or desired uses up there.
No, I know. Again, since I've been commissioner, we've had the conflicts up there. Well, no, we don't want snowmobiles in our front yard. No, and then so we allow them to go on our right of way, and then trying to make sure that the right of way plowed off snowbank, which can be 15 feet tall, is sometimes safe and not putting people in jeopardy of running off into the road with the snow machine too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say thanks to the Columbine Cabins, because they've let a number of folks park there, because the quarry parking lot inevitably maxes capacity on a good snow day or a weekend, and then you have folks strung out along the road. And so I think the need is there. I don't have any quantification with me in terms of numbers, but just anecdotally by what I've seen there in conversations, there's definitely a need and an interest.
Yeah, I think for us specifically, probably we would hope get past the private land issues that we're having with some of the private landowners alongside of 129 and up where the start 550 is that don't want to have the snow machines. If we actually take them into the forest and where the parking lot is, then we're past all that. But we hopefully are past that conflict.
Yes, because our plan was, once we got Columbine open, to really marginalize the quarry parking lot for just minimal parking, not likely trailers or larger rigs, just a handful of passenger vehicles.
So I guess the question might be, you know, and again, it's kind of like this mad rabbit. You need a few more things put on your list, but, you know, if we need to help convene some type of a meeting for them, them people up there. You know, I don't want to do it on myself, and I don't want to have to tell us to tell Ray, go plow that damn thing out. And then, well, then we got half of them happy and half of them mad and about what we're doing with it. So if we can come up with some type, you know, if we have to convene some meetings up there, and we actually might sponsor some meeting, summer meeting up there with us tonight when we're not this sure. deep in snow, and have some conversation on what everybody else kind of wants to have happen and see how we can collectively move forward and do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, again, we would be happy to participate in that. I think independently we have all been having conversations with the residents and the snow club and the various folks up there, and I think you're probably spot on, Doug. It's maybe just time to convene a table and have a bit of a larger discussion.
The worst thing is just like you say, when you meet with the snow club, well, you hear their story, and then you meet with private people, you hear their story, and try to tie them all together and have a community-driven solution versus us having to pick what the solution is and picking some sort winners and some sort losers out of the thing. So, well,
yeah, one of our observations is that if we do plow it, because we can't leave 3 foot, we can't. Take it almost down to the gravel anyway. We'll leave a little bit, but the road will probably start falling out, falling apart before the snow up high is gone, and so that could possibly cut people off going up through there. Whereas if it's got 4 foot, 5 foot of snow, it's going to take a while. That'll go away about the same time the snow up high. That was one concern. I'm not a snow machiner. I would like to be left seat in my garage.
Yeah, I am not a road person. So, I mean, I think those are all really conversations that we have.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, we're willing to do it. We're willing to try it last year. So just, you know, the timing would be good still. We could, you know, if we decide, we're still looking at front end loader replacements, the knee versus maybe pushing them out. But we do have a couple that are, if they're not replaced next year, they need to be done in the next couple of years. But we can try it, and we can do deferred replacement, see how it will work. Really get an idea of how long it's going to take, because I've been told two things. You know, we're going to maintain the road, and somebody else is going to maintain the parking lot. I don't know how that's going to work to me.
Yeah, it was depending on what side of the table you were sitting on when the deal was being made.
I was all for it.
That's right.
You know, I don't remember. I just know we were going to plow up there. I didn't realize we were going to plow the parking lot either.
I think that was discussed.
Because we were looking at adding 15 minutes on our plow road to get up there from where it was going to be at and swing back around 15 minutes back. You know, we're talking about maybe adding a half hour to our plow guy's route. So, well, that's, you know, we can do that. That's not a big deal. But if we start plowing the whole parking lot, that's a big
deal. All right. We probably should. Dan's itching to talk about public health, I can tell. Okay. So it sounds like there's some further conversation
whatever you
want to
continue
about that.
Sooner, better than later.
Okay, that sounds good.
Just so we, because we're doing the budget now, so we can have options. But we've already thought about this.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Tara.
Thanks, Tara.
Yep.
Yeah. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to see you guys.
Yeah.
Should be a good year for wildland fires, right?
Keep knocking on wood.
Yeah. Here's hoping.
Here's hoping.
Deanna, it looks like we didn't get public comment in the agenda, so we just need to make sure we do that. And it's at 10:45 usually.
Oh, we forgot about it.
Well, it's just not on there. I mean, we would have had it if someone were here, but
for future reference, we always have public comment at 10:45.
Right.
On Tuesday.
All right, Dan.
Okay.
We're ready.
This is a ratification of several agreements or programs related to public health, agreements with the state of Colorado through CDPHE, the Department of Public Health and Environment. And so a little bit of, I guess, overarching summary, hopefully, of what we're doing here. You know, this is a new thing for us, these programs, and so I sort of apologize for the hasty nature of all this, but ratifying the chair's signature on three agreements, one for immunizations in the amount of $33,451, one for local core public health services, which includes maternal child health, child fatality, and overarching core services that this particular case is notable that it would be communicable disease surveillance activities. That is in the amount of $116,389. And then a local emergency preparedness and response award of $26,956. So a little bit of background, the immunization contract, we talked a little bit about this during the work session yesterday, that the intent there is to subcontract that program through Northwest Colorado Health at the current time and in the future to do an RFP in future years. The core immunization services really are a preventative measure that provide vaccines for children in particular, but for others who may need vaccination in order to prevent the spread of disease and prevent the spread of things that we don't want in the community. Thinking about measles, tuberculosis, those things that sort of are in the news a lot lately. And so the work there is working with the schools, working throughout the community, providing some level of awareness around the immunization rate nationally, state and countywide, and trying to increase the number of people getting immunized.
Can I ask I have a question about that. So I heard you describe an education and community awareness program, which makes sense. And then there's also a literal immunization component to this program too, right? Like providing clinics, whatever. And is the focus of that people with insurance, without insurance, both?
My understanding, and I apologize.
No,
I'm
it's
not
okay.
The expert
I know.
On that, is that it would be people without insurance.
But, okay.
I believe there is a component where if there are people who come with insurance, that they might get a referral, or that there might be additional immunizations or vaccines that could be drawn from the stockpile to replace those. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of build the insurance for that.
Yeah.
That the intent is really to cover the uninsured and people who would be at a higher need. But I'm speaking a little bit out of turn on that.
Yeah, that's okay. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the intent should be noted is to immunize those who need that versus maybe those who go to their primary care physician or other sources.
Yeah, but the big picture, the goal is to increase the number of people who are immunized,
to
right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And disease contraction, spread, et cetera.
The herd immunity kind of concept.
I seem to at least recall when it was VNA. Anybody could take their kid in and get it vaccinated. You didn't have to pay. You didn't have to do anything. Just bring your kids in and get them vaccinated.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Because I'm not sure.
I know. I think they still had copays.
Did they?
Yeah, I think there is.
I guess I don't really know.
I think that's part of my question about, because I've had some experiences too. Like I know Will at Yampa Valley Bank, they have an immunization clinic, and it's done by Northwest Colorado Health. I know at Clark's Daycare, they do an immunization clinic, and parents can come, and kids can come, and they did bill our insurance, but I assume people who are not insured, and I'm just curious if that's part of this same program or not.
I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the intent is if there is insurance, they'll bill the insurance, again, to kind of replenish the supply.
And I think it depends on which, are you talking about flu, or whether you're talking about some of the other immunizations.
These were flu clinics, I think, specifically. That's a good point.
Part of the overall program.
Okay, just trying to kind of have an understanding of what these programs are.
I think we're all right there.
Yeah. We're getting there.
Can I just, before you keep going, you mentioned three amounts, and I'm noticing the first page has a different amount than any of the three you said, which is $221,952.25. What is that one?
Yeah, I was going to ask the same question.
$221,952.25.
So the contract amendment.
It's the first page of the contract, and it says contract amendment, amendment number two.
Right.
And it just doesn't match any of the things that you said.
That's correct.
Well, we're just blindly signing these, aren't we?
The hell's the matter?
Kind of, yeah.
Now it is.
But we might as well use the right numbers.
But it just doesn't even say what it's an amendment
2. It just says it's an amendment.
So what we typically have been getting is a 5-year overarching agreement with annual renewals, and so that
Scott mentioned that there's a master contract.
Yeah, there's a master agreement, and so this is, I think, the renewal. I understand that CDPHE is changing the way that they're doing contracting. Mm-hmm. So you can see the original contract was 18. The amendment number 1 is 19. Amendment number 2 is 19, but has different numbers.
Right.
So I think the overarching 5-year contract, I think, is the 221, and then there are sub amounts and sub awards.
Amendment 2 goes through 2020.
Yeah.
So in essence, you're asking us to make a motion to approve contract amendment 2019-1055, amendment number 2.
No, there are several different
things
here.
Yeah, but I think that is part of the motion is you know,
that's
I think
one.
The motion we talked about possibly just doing the overall
But I mean, this is...
But yes.
But there, if you scroll through, there's like 4 different signature lines in there, in this thing that's in there. That's just one that I didn't hear you mention. But then... Okay. So Exhibit J, which is page 34 of the packet, also says 2019-1055 Amendment 2, but it has different numbers in it.
Yep.
Let me see here. There is a task order amendment in there along with the other amendment. I'll have the wrong document, I apologize.
So I've only really got 2 documents that I have access to, the intergovernment contract and the amendment number 2 contract. Is there something else I'm missing?
So the 221 document we're looking at is for the core public health services.
Okay. And so the amount that you cited us is that July 1st of 19 through, it's that 1920, whatever that
is. The $90,345?
Yeah, this one. 7/1/19/6/30/20.
I'm reading off of the spreadsheet where we aggregated some stuff, so we may have combined in my spreadsheet, so the accurate number, obviously, in some level is the one we're signing.
The one that's in the contract,
agreement.
The $90,345, that's what we're...
And that's for core public health services.
That's maternal child health, core public health, and child fatality, as I understand.
Okay.
A combination of those things. And I'm just trying to verify that real quick before I speak again out of turn.
It's okay. It's just all very confusing.
Yeah, it is.
So do you want to get started on this? I mean, I could try a motion.
I thought we were going to just motion on all 3 of them.
Yes.
I mean, I already signed all of these. We're just ratifying my signature on them.
I'm curious, so it's really 3 things are you... I mean, that's
so keep going. Keep going.
Yeah, so the page 4, you see
the
work plan for local core public health services. Page, I think, 5 is maternal child health services
keep
work
going.
Plan.
I'm done. That's all I got.
Down, child fatality prevention.
Well, so there's more.
Work plan is in there.
So
I'm going off of the website. You're going off of your packet.
I am, and I think there's just more than one thing in there.
Okay, well, then
so
I'm not
going to
be disadvantaged.
If you go back to the website, I think there were 3 different links there. And you just have... That's the first link.
In
the agenda packet.
So there are 3
so that's the first
services that are in that one.
Oh.
And then there's 2 and then 3. So one on each line there.
I didn't know it on that one. No, that's not what I get. I only get... Oh, no.
Okay. So there's 3 different links
there. Are
3
core programs in there. And at the very last page, Exhibit J, there's a budget for the task order that is 2019-1055 task order. This is agreement 18 FAAA 97494. So there is local planning and support of a total of 97 272 272 sorry that is multiple budget years, it looks like, that, you know, you're getting $24,000.
So the best thing, Dan, is to come up with some titles on each of those. The one here starts off at amendment number two. And so, you know, we come up with amendment number two. And then we got the master contract. Is that what you said?
Well, there's a task order and then specific amendments to that. I think the master task order is 5 years, and then
you got the amendment two, you got the task order.
I think Doug's right. It would be good to have titles for each of the three things we're signing, and we can note those in the motion and in the minutes. Yeah, just so we're clear on what has been signed here.
So I've got, and I can note off my notes the original and the sort of contract number element of that.
That sounds good.
How that ties back to...
That's fine. Even if we have a contract number is fine. We can identify it. So what's the master task order?
Well, so the three for this year, I think maybe it's easier to do it that way.
Okay.
Immunizations is contract number 20FHHA.
20F?
Two H's A. 128230.
Okay.
And that's the amount of $33,451.
Okay.
The local core public health services is the one that includes maternal child health, child fatality, core public health.
Okay.
That is 18FAAA97494.
Say it. F-F-A-A.
It's F-A-A-A. So F and three A's.
Okay.
One F, three A's.
Yep.
97494.
Okay.
And the amount of 116389.
Okay.
And then emergency preparedness is CT2020274. In the amount of $26,956.
I'll trust you.
Yeah.
And those are the three different ones that I signed.
Agreements, right. Okay. And so just a little bit of background about the EPR, Emergency Preparedness Response. This is a local coordination grant. This is, we talked about as well yesterday, that there is a regional EPR coordinator, we're working on that agreement right now, that Rao County would take that over and essentially hire that individual, the coordinator, for the regional program. But this is funding for local county responsibility, not the regional. So this provides public health preparedness, participating in coordination with the other regional emergency response functions, providing a healthcare perspective on some of those elements, providing participation in drills and pandemic or medical related issue planning, and maintaining general preparedness and response capabilities in the county. And again, specific to the county, not the regional component. Local planning and support, maternal child health and child fatality. The intent is that we would have communicable disease surveillance provided through Northwest Colorado Health. The rest of these programs probably would be done through the county, through the public health director. But that's assessment, planning, and communication around the health assessment process and planning and the public health improvement plan. So essentially setting goals for public health in the community. And vital records provision and statistics, and that'd be birth and death records. Communicable disease surveillance and reporting would be done by Northwest Colorado Health, and specific to essentially incidences of measles, tuberculosis, other kinds of communicable diseases that can have an impact on the community. Prevention and health promotion activities, emergency preparedness for public health is sort of done in there as well. Obviously, there's the EPR grant too. Administration and governance, so policies for public health, and then maternal child health outcome improvement. So essentially, like having a baseline and trying to improve outcomes there, and child fatality reviews and prevention activities. So those are all the things that would be funded through those three grants.
So through the on the emergency preparedness, I believe, based on our conversation with Carrie yesterday, that she really is taking on that role. So yeah. Does that mean that most of that fund goes toward her salary?
Right now, that would be the intent for the local money, the $26,000 we're talking about.
Yep.
Yeah, and she then, provide the emergency support function aid, which is public health.
Okay.
So are we going to have another agreement to take care of the Jim Johnson thing?
Yes.
Maybe a later time?
I sure hope so, and it's going to happen. July 1
is the mail.
Yeah.
And then am I to understand on that third category, that third contract, that a portion of that will be contracted out to Northwest Colorado Health for some of their services, and the remainder would support our public health director position?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
Those activities would be performed by the
director. Okay.
You know, that's kind of what we're talking about, is the director providing anything that we take on.
Yep.
And then any subcontracting activity would be through Northwest Colorado Health, because they had been providing that activity before, and then evaluating that after this contract year.
Okay, are you ready?
I'm so ready, Doug. Are you ready? That's the real question.
No.
We're there.
Yeah. So,
we're just all trying to kind of figure it out one step at a time together.
Good luck with the minutes.
I have documentation.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve and ratify the Chair's signature on intergovernmental contracts between Route County and the State of Colorado, Department of Public Health and Environment, Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response. Specifically, that would be contracts 20FHHA 128230, and that is the immunization contract for $33,451. The contract 18FAAA97494, that's the core public health, in the amount of $116,389. And the contract CT2020274, the emergency preparedness, in the amount of $26,956.
Second.
You had the hard part. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thanks, Dan.
I got to go to a housing authority meeting.
I do, too, and I won't be back at one. I'm going to hang out in my cave. I'm trying to buy some cows.
And
I'll be...
I'll probably be 15.
That would be great.
Sure.
You met Deanna.
We did.
Our lovely new office assistant. What's your actual title? Is that your title? Every time I say it, I'm like,
it's receptionist and minutetaker. Yes.
So I think we should invent a new title for you.
Sure.
We'll come up with something really cool. All right. Go ahead.
So I'm Brett Parker, district attorney.
And Matt Carson, assistant DA.
Great. And you're just here to give us an update on what's going on in your office.
Well, it was intended only to formally kind of introduce ourselves. And firstly, just I wanted to thank the board for the support of me in the office over the years I've been here. And I guess of all the commissioners, I've been with Commissioner Monger in this process the longest, obviously, Mr. Sullivan as well. But I think the Route County Commission, County Board of County Commissioners, has been unwavering in their support, and that doesn't mean they gave us everything we asked for. It's meant that there's been a healthy, respectful dialogue about the needs of our office. The board was always receptive to the information that we had, responsive to needs when we could identify and justify pay increases, for instance, and I really, really appreciate that. I think it's helped build the team we have now, which is, I think, in a secure place. Matt had a large part in helping us build that team, and he's now well-positioned to take it over. Commissioner Munger heard this line already, but Senator Allison once said the highways of humility are not burdened by heavy traffic, and Matt happens to be on that highway. He's one of the most humble and thoughtful people I've ever worked with, and I mean, at the same time, brings an enormous talent and experience to the job. So I was enormously appreciative of his board's support of Matt's appointment, and thank you for that. I think it was important for the long term of his team that we built and worked so hard to build. I think stability in rural offices, DA's offices, with term limits the way they are, is really hard to achieve, and I think we've with this appointment, we hopefully we're on a path to sustain that.
Thank you, Mr.
I got nervous about leaving her alone at the weekend. Hurry back.
I can function unsupervised.
Thank you.
Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you.
I haven't made too many decisions while you were gone, so don't worry.
They were all good decisions.
Our budget went up 10%. Thank you for that.
I was just speaking about what I think we're in a great place. I think maintaining, building a culture of excellence and maintaining it and improving it in a rural office particularly is an almost generational project. I think we've come some way in Matt's position to carry it on. And that's important to a rural community. It's important to our partners in law enforcement, particularly because they abhor change, they abhor instability just in general, and us too. I think it doesn't serve the community well, it doesn't serve our victims well if there's a constant turnover in the office. And we're, for the first time, 7 of our 9 attorneys in this office are either married or engaged, have property in the area. And that's just, to my knowledge and recollection, never been done before, and it just speaks well of the people that are committed to the work that they're doing and to the office and the service that we provide. So bottom line is, and before you came in, I was just expressing formally my thanks to the board for the support of our office and this appointment. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Matt and let him speak to you as the designate and
July 1st,
the DA in 5 more days. That's right.
July 1.
Which is July next 1. Week.
It's Monday.
It's a lot of things are happening on July 1st.
I know. Well, thank you, Brett. And I will echo what Brett said. I've been in this business for about 25 years, both in rural and urban bigger offices. And the challenges that rural offices face, whether it's with term limits or cost of living in resort towns and all of these things, I cannot say enough, and I can't express my appreciation in words about Brett's stewardship and leadership in the 5 years since I came back to Steamboat. We are postured as strong as we possibly could be, not just for the immediate time, but for the future in terms of our staffing, particularly. The budget's in progress for 2020. You guys know Donna. So I've been working with Donna, and we expect to have something to you, I think, here soon to Rock County Finance. Is it Randa? Is that
Randa?
Yeah. Yes.
Contact person.
Yeah. So we're putting finishing touches on that proposal. I didn't see any nasty surprises. Donna didn't see any nasty surprises. So that's good news. In terms of the transition, July 1, a couple of things I wanted to let you all as commissioners know. There are some challenges that we face that are statewide issues, mental health, treatment services, all of those things. And those are long-term priorities. And I've got some ideas about that, which I'm happy to share, but I don't want to impose them on anybody that doesn't want to hear about them. The immediate impact for the office on Monday, a couple of things. One is, as part of this staffing jackpot that we've sort of hit, some of you might know Matt Chesfold. He's going to be the assistant DA. He is a 10-year attorney, a really strong litigator, really objective, a lot of great skill sets, and he's going to be a huge, has been in his role as chief deputy in the Moffitt office. He's going to be a great asset district-wide and a huge help to me. And then Catherine Dowdell, who I don't think you all know, she's been in Moffitt for about 4 years, and I think in another 3 or so over in Grand, she's going to be the chief deputy. So those are our new transitions, or the chief deputy position is being kind of resurrected for Grand County. Matt Chesfold and I, one of the things we're planning to do for at least 2 months, this initial 60-day period, and then evaluate and see if that's working well, if it's contributing in helpful ways to our frontline staff. We're going to be rotating throughout the district. So I'll have one day, Mondays in route, Friday afternoons in route, Tuesdays in Grand County, Wednesdays and Thursdays in Moffitt, and then Matt will be, have a different schedule. What we're trying to accomplish here is 2 things. One, make sure each county office has one of us, either me or Chesfold, in it at least 1 day per week to support and help and guide as best we can. And then also Moffitt County, which remains our busiest county. We have 3 full-time prosecutors over there. We have 2 in Route and 2 in Grand, and the 3 full-time prosecutors over in Moffitt, often will need just hands-on support in the trenches. So 5 days per week, one of us, you know, will either be or
someone's going to be
will be there. The only other two things, I guess, or one thing in particular that's sort of a concrete, tangible change is we're going to start putting either Chestfold and I on all sex offense cases from the beginning of the case. And most of those are going to be felony sex assaults. So those cases will have two attorneys assigned to them. Every single one of them will. And one of them will be the two most experienced attorneys in the office, either myself or Chestfold, and then the regularly assigned deputy DA. Obviously, high-priority cases, and it's an outstanding training opportunity for us to build strong, you know, violent crime or major case prosecutors out of our younger lawyers. And then the other thing is for anything involving a Class 3 felony or higher, which is rare, oftentimes they are also sex assaults, thankfully relatively rare in our jurisdiction, but those will have the, either myself, Chestfold, or Catherine, our chief in the grand office, and the deputy DA on them once they set for trial. The sex assaults are going to be loaded up from the time we hear about the crime, and then the Class 3, for example, burglary, residential burglary. If the case can't resolve and it's tracking towards a trial, we're going to assign, in addition to the deputy DA, one of our more experienced prosecutors. We may adjust that. We'll see how that works. I think it'll work well. I've, again, been doing it a long time and familiar with what happens in our jurisdiction. And I think those are our two most serious sort of categories of offenses that we see. Class 3 felony or higher going to trial or felony sex assault. One of the other sort of long-term projects, and by long-term I mean over the next few months, I guess I shouldn't say long-term, that we have to address is a particular piece of legislation from the 2019 session, which doesn't take effect until March 1, 2020. And it takes what used to be relatively low-level amounts of narcotics, methamphetamine, heroin, that sort of thing, out of the felony category and makes a misdemeanor. So possession of, for example, under 4 grams of methamphetamine as of March 1, 2020 will be a misdemeanor. Once you rack up enough, it becomes a felony again.
What was the threshold again?
4 grams for methamphetamine. And I can provide any other information you want. Off the top of my head, I'm specifically remembering 4 grams.
What does that mean? I mean, what is 4 grams? I have no idea.
4 grams I would consider to be a personal use amount.
One or two hits.
Well, yeah, one or two, okay. Or maybe a couple of people. It's certainly not indicative of distribution. So, I mean, the legislature carved that out in a sensible way in terms of distinguishing, in my opinion, between people that are possessing and people that are possessing with intent to distribute or distribute.
Yep.
So my personal sense is that's a good start on sort of examining the efficacy of how the criminal justice system and addiction intersect. The problem is it didn't come with a lot of funding or anything.
Oh, no, shocking. Right.
So, you know, I always, the way I've been describing it is, you know, the criminal justice system has never been sort of adequately kitted to deal with, outfitted to deal with addiction and mental health, but it's sort of in the repository by default.
Right.
And, you know, you could say that this legislation, if it doesn't come at some point with more help, is really just taking away what ill-suited tools we already have and not replacing them, like giving us a sledgehammer when the job requires a scalpel. The impact for the counties immediately, we ran some numbers, and Rauch County saw somewhere between 150 and 175 what we call DF4, felony possession cases, in a 4.5-year period between 2015 and now. So not a ton, but it's not insignificant.
So I'm curious, by virtue of turning those offenses into misdemeanors, doesn't that relieve some pressure on the DA's office?
In a sense, yes, because so what happens is
those... Did you turn your microphone on? Sorry. Or Deanna trying to listen to them later.
Those cases are still in our office, but they will no longer be district court cases. They will start and end in county court. So Judge Garrett's caseload will go up by 25 to 30 cases per year.
True. But they're simpler cases to prosecute.
They in theory, yes. My concern, or one of my immediate concerns is this. So very little leverage behind those misdemeanors. The legislation did come, normally when a crime, if you go to jail, you can only get up to 60 days, if you get probation, you can only get up to 60 days in the county jail on a misdemeanor. So this statute provides for an opportunity for the judge to impose probation, which can be important to maintain a functional recovery and treatment program, but then more significant jail. So you can get, there's a carrot and a stick there. Having said that, there's just less leverage generally. So what I think might happen, at least initially, is, and I don't mean this as a slight to my brothers and sisters in the defense bar, I've done that work before. If the prosecution doesn't have leverage, and you're not worried about helping your client get better, you're just worried about getting him off the hook, which is the mandate of the defense attorney, then, and you know that the backside of a trial is really not that bad, we could see a spike in jury trials, in the numbers of jury trials. I don't know if that'll happen or not, and I've been spending a lot of time, at least in my own head, trying to come up with some creative solutions on how to maybe divert those out of the system and focus on recovery. But that is something that we'll be discussing inside the office and then amongst our fellow district attorneys through CDAC in the coming few months. So that's
you mentioned the experts that are required.
Oh, yes, that's one of the biggest hits. So if there's a spike in trials, so all of our taking a case like that to trial requires testimony from the CBI crime lab. We don't have any local testing facilities, and we can't presumptive tests that the police use out on the street just to do a check are not admissible for those purposes in a trial. So all of those would require full analysis by the CBI's lab, and we utilize the Morning Grand Junction mainly. And then a trip up here from a CBI analyst, lab tech, forensic chemist, and then probably overnight stay, and then testimony from them. I have no idea how CBI is going to react to the jurisdictions that see these spikes in the number of trials on these cases. The numbers shouldn't change. The number of trials may change. And so I suspect we may get some strong pushback from CBI.
Does CBI bill your office?
No.
Okay.
No, they don't.
Interesting. So do we have a drug court system in Route County?
We have a recovery court system in Route County.
Is that the same thing?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it is.
I'm only familiar with drug court from listening to Serial. So.
No, drug court is a thing here.
Listening to
it's
who?
The new Serial. It's a podcast.
Yeah. It's a new fancier name for exactly the same.
Okay.
Yes. Right. I think they've only rebranded it in the past 18 months or 3 years.
Okay.
We do have one. One of the things I would like to do is to get with Judge O'Hara, who presides over that, and some other stakeholders and figure out a way. If the leverage is always a problem, everything we can do in the criminal justice system is off leverage. Setting that aside, is there a way to make more use or better use or more robust use of our recovery work program is sort of one of the first avenues I think we need to explore.
So your thought is that there could be potentially some
absolutely
growth of that.
Yes.
I've heard this referred to as a drug court and as a recovery court.
Right.
Which is it?
That's what I just said.
It is officially recovery court.
Officially, okay.
Yes.
Officially.
Recovery court.
Yep. So how's it working? I mean, Judge O'Hara instituted that probably about 6 years ago, mm-hmm. So it's been functioning for a while.
A little longer, maybe 10 years ago.
I think, it's more heavily populated in Moffitt County. My perception, and I mean this in no way as a criticism of anybody who's been involved as a stakeholder up to now, but my perception is that one of the reasons why it maybe hasn't had the numbers that I think it probably could is the front end criteria. What criteria is there to get into the drug court program? When are you eligible? And then more importantly, and there was a shift in leadership at the probation department a couple of years ago, which I think helped. Are there criteria that just exclude you from drug courts? So, for example, certain grant-funded drug courts, if there's a gun involved anywhere in the facts of the case, you can't participate.
Yeah,
I get the idea behind that, but for sure we were losing, and we didn't have that here,
yeah,
but jurisdictions like that were losing people that could have benefited. And, for example, it used to be you had to have it had to be a felony charge. You weren't eligible if it was a misdemeanor. And then we sort of brought that down to the M1, the highest level misdemeanor level. Right now, I think the biggest challenge of getting people into drug court is it's hard work. You have to want to recover. And if we have less leverage and they don't want to recover, we can make it available all day, but they're not going to choose to go into it, which is why I think I know some of our colleagues are considering like adult diversion programs, so you can provide that incentive. You know, you just sort of divert it out of the prosecution world and give them an opportunity to attend, participate in a recovery court program, with the back end being the case is never even filed, you know, as opposed to, well, we won't send you to prison for a long time. That's not in the cards. It really never has been. So I'm real hopeful, and I think it's a good program. Judge O'Hara puts a lot of time and energy into that, and I'm looking forward to partnering with them as best I can.
I was at a NACO conference, the National Association of Counties, and they I went to a session on mental health, mental illness, and the criminal justice system, and there was a county there that talked about that they had set up a parallel type of court for folks who have mental health issues to try to divert them from the system. And I just thought it was interesting. I mean, it's hard to find the resources to do something like that, but I thought it was really compelling to kind of think about who really should be in jail,
right?
And who benefits by having folks in jail, and who maybe could we put them on a different path where they'd be more successful.
There are some good programs out there. I think some jurisdictions have veterans courts. They have mental health court. I think Judge O'Hara is in the early stages, or he's talked about something called problem-solving court, which, and I don't know exactly what that is, but it sounds like
it sounds cute.
It does sound cute. and so, yeah, I think, you know, that is, if you can sort of hybrid diversion programs with purposed courts like that, I think that's a good starting point. There's only so much we can do in the criminal justice system that impacts what is a much broader societal issue, but we want to do all we can.
Talk about just limited resources from mental health or addiction in our community.
Yes, we have, and that's
we are well aware.
Just read the paper, you know, losing the, I guess, crisis services from MindSprings. Pam, my wife, came up with a good idea. I read a case report involving a juvenile in Oak Creek last night, and the case just screams out, the kid just, he needs therapy, he needs some coping skills. They may need some other help. And I was talking to Pam, and she came up with a great idea maybe of for some possible private funding source, at least locally here in Rock County, to help at-risk youth. And then what does it mean to be an at-risk youth? Does it just mean there's a child facing delinquency prosecution? Or does it mean there's a child whose parents are facing criminal prosecution, and that makes the kid at risk? And that would, to my way of thinking, might expand the class of people we can maybe get some services for. So we're thinking about gathering data so I can do it intelligently, but I'm thinking about approaching an entity in town here to see if we can't get some grant funding or something similar.
Communities that care.
Yes. Yeah, I just learned about that today. I was talking to Mark Elliott.
We're skeptical.
Okay.
So you... it sounds like some of these things you've just touched on goes back to what you were talking about, a focus on mental health.
Yeah.
Because I was curious. I mean, what can a DA do to positively impact mental health? It sounds like you just ticked off some ideas and programs that would go into that.
And substance abuse, right? And
yes,
I mean,
both.
Knowing
both.
That they're not identical.
Yeah,
they're
both like that anyway.
Exactly, yes. So it's going to be a challenge, but I could not be more excited about it. So.
I think it's great, and I think it's wonderful to have more partners working on that, because it is such an increasing need. I mean, there's no question that the resources are not there, and identifying where those resources can come from and advocating for those resources being available. I mean, it saves us money in our court system and in our jail if we can kind of flip that paradigm over a little bit.
Yes. And my door is always open. We'll be back, I guess, in a couple of weeks with some budget presentation, or I think we just give that to Randa. Is that right?
Yeah, it goes to Randa first, and then we'll schedule a meeting.
Yep.
Whether or not we need to meet with me first and the county department versus just wait until we have the... You know, three county meetings. We'll have that discussion.
Okay.
And did the legislation that adjusted some of the pay scale, did that pass or not pass? It did not pass.
Okay.
I don't remember.
So in your budget preparations, you know, you guys have been constrained in the past, not so much by Rob County, but by our partner counties. And we kind of all hold hands on this. Do you have a sense that that Grant and Moffitt may be in slightly better position than they have been in the past?
I think Moffitt continues to struggle. I think they're going to be the main concern. I didn't get that sense. We were in Grand Canyon last week. I didn't get the sense that they're looking at anything
dire. I think we can assume that
Moffitt County is concerned.
That's probably a safe assumption.
And on that point, though, and I will raise the issue again of 2021, you need to pay this guy some more. The state. So I think the states, I don't see any increase in pay, the base pay the DA gets, which is what we've had here since it came into effect. But I think, and I'll let Matt give you the data, but I think somebody that runs the largest law organization in Northwest Colorado with the most significant impact, in my opinion, ought to be paid a little bit better. So.
My recollection is we had a conversation that included raising that scale, and you were very negative about that.
I was negative because it was in the middle of the term, and I don't think it's legal to raise.
Yeah, it wouldn't have mattered. Still have to go through election, just like us.
Didn't we have this discussion? We don't have the latitude to be able to arbitrarily raise it on our own?
You can at the beginning of the term.
Oh, without legislative action.
But we have to work with all three. It would be all three committees,
right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And I think there was, Commissioner, I think exactly there. I think there was a consensus. I think it was one of the three-way meetings we did last year, as a matter of fact, about doing that.
You shot it down.
I don't think it's legal to do.
Because it was not legal.
I don't need
to. Well, I also think you made some comments that you wanted to reserve the additional money to be paid to your staff. But at a certain point in time, I think we do need to recognize what you just said about the importance of this position and that it be paid fairly.
Well, and Matt being a humble person, will be hesitant to ask about that. So I'm asking on his behalf in advance.
So if by some miracle our partner counties had enough money to go along with that, we would have to make that decision sometime before the end of 2020.
It'd have to be part of the 2021 budget, I would think, those discussions. Okay. So, summer, fall of next year, that would be right, I think.
Well, and theoretically, you could make that decision, but it couldn't go into effect until an election.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's so.
And we can
only make that going to be 2020.
Right.
And we can only make that commitment on a year-to-year basis.
Yeah, I think you could express a positive intent like they did last year, but I don't think you can act on it until that budget's voted on.
That makes sense.
2020, seriously. Anyway.
Well, we're not going to do anything illegal.
And I strongly...
Well, we're not strongly encouraged.
Not on purpose, anyway.
Not today.
Yeah.
Tomorrow's a different day.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your focus and your continued focus on culture within your own office. I mean, and like you said, that's a long-term project. It takes years and years and years. You just got to keep after it.
Yes.
And especially when you're dealing with, as you said, an elected head of that office who has term limits, and so maintaining that continuity and momentum is tough. So thank you for that.
All right.
Anything else?
Thanks for your
time. All right. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Commissioner
Carroll. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Good luck in your future endeavors. You're going to go back to being a student.
I'm going to be, you've seen the movie Old School, right, with Will Ferrell? This is way older school.
So Brent's going back to school. You heard him say that?
We'll see you around, Matt.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sure we'll see you.
Let us know if you need anything.
Will do. Thanks.
So it's not new locks on your interior doors.
Come on up.
I always sit over there. I'm shaking.
You're going to
shaking it up.
Screw us up. Got to keep us on our toes, right? Go ahead, Julie.
Okay, we are here for approval and authorization by the Board of County Commissioners for the Chair to sign the professional service agreement and authorization for the County Manager to electronically sign the purchase order to True North Consulting Group, LLC, in the amount of $29,200 for campus security assessment services. This budget, it's currently budgeted at $17,000 because the original budget was $37,000, and we allocated $20,000 over to the human services security reconfiguration of the front lobby. And due to the fact that the plans have been delayed and things have stalled that project, and now that we're so close to having the security assessment, we've decided to include the DHS lobby reconfiguration in the security assessment so that we get the best value for what we're looking to do for them, you know, based on some professional recommendations. So hold on.
So we're going to do a security assessment for the front lobby of the DHS.
For the whole campus.
I understand. For the whole campus, we're going to include DHS, for which we already have done an architectural design to address the security concerns.
Yep.
We're helping.
Okay. It's for their review.
It's for the review, okay. And make sure that we're really hitting
before
the
before we actually build it.
Well,
since
yeah.
It's so close.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's fine.
The timing is such that we okay. Just
so
fill.
We,
I think
so
we heard from our staff that they didn't agree with the
I understand
design.
That, too.
So we are looking for some professional advice on the design, and so we may need a supplemental budget. We'll decide that at the end of the year, and we see what they do come back with for that, because if we could get that done in 2019, we'd like to. So we did, I sent out RFP 638 to 13 vendors, and we received 20 proposals.
Wow.
This is excellent. That means that our website is
20
working.
Proposals?
Yeah.
20
it's
proposals.
Quite a review process.
These guys are all hungry, is it? They're not overworked.
Well, this is the, you know, this is like Y2K, you know, the data upgrades. I mean, I think that security is a very hot item right now.
Yeah.
And when you look at the range of pricing for, you know, our spec is pretty open because we don't really know what we need, but we definitely ask that we have a proposal that will include things that we can spread over maybe 3 years, you know, to get it all done. And, you know, give us what are the big items we need to hit and let us budget through that process. So they were all meeting those requirements, but definitely at varied prices. So we had an evaluation committee that included Dan Weinheimer, Steve Faulkner, Deputy Tom Hall, and Undersheriff Doug Scherer. Of those 20, the three highlighted were selected for interviews based on their experience and initial scoring. After the second round of evaluating the top three, the committee has selected True North Consulting Group because 87% of their clients are in similar government offices that require security, yet must be open and accessible during business hours to the public. True North has also prepared assessments for 12 Colorado Mountain College campuses, so they seem best qualified to understand our unique needs here in Steamboat.
I just had one question as I glanced through their proposal. So in section D, which I think is on page 28, they say we would provide our services from our Minnesota branch office. Does that mean they're not going to come here?
Oh, no, they'll be on site.
Okay.
Yes, they'll definitely be on site.
They'll make
interview.
Two trips, right?
They're making 2 to 3 trips. And so they will come out, and they're going to evaluate both day and night, and they'll be interviewing several key employees. And then they'll go back and get the data all pulled together, get our proposal, and they'll be back in person to make a presentation to you.
Okay. I figured that was the case, but then I read that and was like just confused by
no,
it.
No, we need
so
we need,
that yeah, that makes
we need
sense.
Hands
okay.
On.
Yeah, they have offices in several states, but not in Colorado.
So I didn't actually read the RFP. Is there something in the RFP that makes it clear to the bidder that we're not looking for a proposal that comes back and suggests we spend $20 million on, I mean, is there some bookends within that RFP that help them understand?
Yes, we asked for a reasonable, you know, in taking into account the size of our town and the, you know, once they do the studies on what the dangers are and, you know, what are the key things that we're looking for,
okay.
we want a realistic proposal that we can implement over several years. We don't want to come in and just go hog wild and shut the place down.
That's
well, and they'll do that.
this risk assessment matrix too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
We'll get the red, yellow, orange, green mm-hmm. on, so we can make some determinations
so
about what's most important.
You know, there could be several areas that are low-lying fruit that we can do for very little money in the beginning, just even training people on how to be aware of things that they should be looking for. You know, how are you going to exit the building in an emergency? You know, training on that, that's not big dollars, but
right.
very important.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Are you ready?
Yeah,
I'm ready.
Get an
app, too, you know?
Oh, yeah, I saw.
An app?
To get you in the building?
Yes, I don't know.
Great.
Yeah, what is the picture of the app for? Oh, it says optional.
Yeah, I'm just playing. We're good. I think this will be great, and so we'll look forward to the process.
Yeah, sounds good.
Madam Chair, I would move that we approve and authorize your signature on the professional service agreement and authorize the county manager, if I assume that meant to say, to electronically sign the purchase order to True North Consulting Group, LLC, in the amount of $29,200 for campus security assessment services.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very
Thanks.
Much.
Also, the goal is to have all the pricing in by August 15th so we can send for budget numbers on the things that we
do. Oh, yeah. I noted that. Great. Okay. Thank you. Come on up. How are you? Good. Hi there. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. We're doing my economic security admin first. Is that what's next?
Yep,
okay.
That's it.
Perfect. So I'm requesting, with the help of Kathy from HR, we have a 28-hour-a-week position, and we've had a vacancy for an admin 3 since March of a front desk tech. And during this time frame, we've been kind of piloting a model where we have the admin 4 person, the tech, sit up front, and be the second person for the front desk. So the request is, instead of hiring the vacant admin 3, which is a full-time position, I'd like to just make the 28-hour-a-week position full-time. And then you'll see that it's actually a cost savings of about $34,000. And I think it better serves our community. So then instead of having 2 front desk people that call a tech in from the back, the tech that's up front can help with that. And just rotate that tech throughout the week, sitting up front.
And so that's the same pay scale as what the techs all get and the rest and everything?
The admin 3 was a lower pay scale. The admin 4 was a little bit higher. But with the complete vacancy, and we're just really, in theory, adding 12 hours to a 28-hour-a-week position, it comes to a cost savings of about $34,000. And we did actual numbers with the person and their health insurance and all that to come to that.
So approving the supplemental budget as well, then?
Right. I don't think it needs to be supplemental because I already have it in the budget.
Yes. Supplemental isn't needed here. It's just changing. It's a decrease in FTEs, but
it has a supplemental budget in here.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, I just did the forms that I did every time I did a personal request.
That was just for the request. I didn't notice that. But no, we don't need it supplemental.
I just gave the information, so sorry if I did wrong. More
information. No, that's all right. That's all right. I just so
we don't need a supplemental budget to do.
No, it's actually a cost savings of about $34,000.
Well, and there's actually a decrease in hours too. FTEs. So I mean, if it would have been an increase in FTEs, even with the cost savings, it would have required a supplemental budget.
Got it.
So help me understand again how one person will perform these functions better than 2.
So we used to have 2 people sit up the front desk.
Right.
And they were not trained to be economic security techs because of the layout.
They were just admins.
They were just admins. So they just answered the phone and did similar jobs. When we had the vacancy, we realized it's a better model to have the front desk person sit at the front desk and then have the tech sit in the back desk. So if someone comes in and they say, I want to change the address on my food assistance case, that person has access to the database and can put it in right there versus the front desk having to call someone to come up to the front and enter it into the computer or write a note and have them do it later on. So the client gets real time, let me do that right now, The layout of our office makes much more sense. You know, we can manage. There was concern, you know, if we get a lot of people in the office, but it's manageable completely. Because a lot of the requests, most of the requests that we get at the front are for economic security, food assistance, Medicaid stuff. You know, the front desk does answer child welfare calls and child support calls, but the majority is the tech, so that person can provide that.
Okay. Thank you.
And so I'm just curious.
Sure.
So there's two names on here. So did one of these two people leave?
Yeah, so Viviana was the front desk person, the admin 3. She took an internal job and got promoted to an admin 4, another tech position.
Got it.
And we had a 28-hour week position that was budgeted, which is difficult to fill, and that person really wants to be full-time. And so it better serves clients with that, and then it's easier to keep that.
So Viviana was in the admin 3 position, was in the 28-hour position.
Other way around. Viviana was a full-time admin 3.
Okay.
Victoria, we should have made something different with that, is a 28. So Victoria's currently at 28 hours. My understanding is we can just promote her. We don't have to, or
got
give
it.
Her the extra hours. It's not even a promotion. Just give her from 28 to 40 and get her full time. And then Viviana's already there. So we just haven't hired that admin 3 position.
She's only listed there to show that there was a vacancy.
Okay.
Right. And that's and her actual salary was the numbers. So that's fine. Yeah.
Got it.
Took me 3 meetings to understand.
No,
so, well, I just wasn't sure why.
Both
these.
So we still have it now. This is a benefited position, which it wasn't before.
Right. So it would be, and so we did even include that in there.
Like, you still get the cost savings.
Yeah.
But we're still.
No, I understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
you're
going from 68 hours to 40 hours.
Exactly. Yeah.
Got
but
it.
we're
adding benefits on that.
Adding benefits
Yep.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the increase of the economic security technician to 40 hours a week, and with the leaving vacant in the admin 3.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Is there an effective date we want for this?
I would like to start at the end of this month since Chris put in a notice and Carmen is on leave. So if we could do that as soon as possible.
And if it's July 1?
Can we do it this month so she can get a benefits for July 1? Like if she starts this week.
She understands the cost implications, right?
I do. We did it in the math. We did it. I understand it's a cost and I know it's a cost of the county, but that's included in the $34,000.
So
because I started this in like April or May.
So you mean the effective date being June 1? Is that what you mean?
Oh, no, like, if she started this week, because don't you have to have one day in the month to get benefits?
I don't know the rules.
She has to start the 28th.
So that would be effective June 25th.
Okay.
My motion.
Second.
Okay, thank you. I
all
appreciate
in favor?
That.
Aye.
Today.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate
all
that.
All good. It's
no
better
problem.
Than having to retroactive it. So
yes.
We're good.
Yes. I got another one, I think, don't I? Signing.
Yes.
You know, but
okay. You don't want to say?
It doesn't.
Come on, stay.
Don't you care about the collaborative management
program? I do. I have chocolate I stole from your
office.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kelly.
I'm asking for a signature on the collaborative management program MOU, which I don't see in front of you. Oh, it's over there.
Oh, yeah. It's over
Deanna?
There.
Okay.
Will you tell us about the collaborative management program?
What the hey?
Collaborative management is funding from divorce fees, and they get trickled down to the counties. And we can manage them and spend them within our community under the approach of multi-system involved families. So families that are involved in probation, child welfare, other mental health services, school-based services. And we get about $90,000, I think it's an $88,000 allocation every year. And we hire Sarah Grippa part-time at 20 hours to manage it. And then we give out about $55,000 to partner agencies and to individuals. So we have client services funds. So to help families with therapeutic services, other programs that would support the family, as well as funding the resiliency program, the day treatment alternative program, and other programs that really hit a variety of kids that are involved in a variety of programs. And the MOU has you write in all the plans that you support with that. The state has guidance on. We want the MOU to show all these partner agencies are at the table. It actually is a really great meeting. We have all three superintendents attend every time. We have, probation, mental health services, other nonprofits at the table, and we meet monthly and have a good conversation and kind of talk about what's going on in the community and how we can support that.
So this is a memorandum of understanding with the state DHS?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it looks like there are mandated and non-mandated partners, and each of those are members of the MOU, too. It looks like they all sign it.
They all have signed it or will be signing it.
So it's not just with DHS.
No, Public Health signs it, Northwest Colorado Health.
Each of the school districts.
Advocates, key partners, probation, the judge.
So there's two pages here that have the signature line. Do you need me to sign both of them?
Oh,
sure.
Or is that just a mistake? Do you want me to just sign them both, just in case?
Yeah, I think the mistake was that I didn't know, because one of them has you and one of them has me as a contract person.
Both of them say me, and it looks like it's a copy of the exact same.
Okay, that's probably what it is. They must have wanted two copies. I only meant to put one, but either one.
If you want me to sign
just it? Do two, just in case. I did that. Sorry about that.
It's all right.
Madam Chair, I would move to approve your signature on the Collaborative Management Program MOU as presented.
Second.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Go off for a second.
Sure.
A consideration from the board for a signature from the chairman of the board on a letter addressed to the State of Colorado Department of Local Affairs to request an extension to the existing grant for a period of 1 year. All the information is in the letter, but I'll summarize. We went out for bid, didn't get any bids. We went out for bid again. We expect to get a couple of bids this time. We have a pre-bid meeting in Pittsburgh tomorrow. We do have a narrow window for construction, and so you think about logistically, they're going to have to take one pond down, operate with two ponds while they're, relining the pond, and so it's a continual process for doing all three ponds. So there's some concern that we aren't going to be able to get this done by the time November 1st rolls around, and really after November 1st, you start to run the risk of having snowfall and freezes, and that operationally makes it a lot more difficult and expensive. So I spoke with Greg Winkler from GOLA, who's our, as you know, our representative. He recommended extending the grant to next year in case the construction goes over into the following year. And so this is just to make sure that we have that funding source and that we don't hit the deadline, which was going to be at the end of this year. So instead it'll be the end of 2020. So any questions for me?
So back, you didn't get any bids the first time it went out?
No.
And then so you sent it back out for, and then we do have, you think you have some interested parties?
Yeah, according to Julie Kennedy, we have a couple of interested parties.
And that's happening when? Tomorrow?
The pre-bid meeting in Pittsburgh is tomorrow. Yeah.
And when's the opening?
It's already open. So it's going to be saying, when are you opening the bids?
The bid
opening.
I don't have it off the top of my head.
I mean, I'm sure from a pre-bid conference to an actual bid, it's got to be 30 days or something like that. When are bids due in from the contractors?
I think that they're due the first week in July. Not a lot occurred. Yeah.
So like next week?
Yeah.
Kind of a short window between a pre-bid and a bid, but it's not that complicated either.
What's our engineer's estimate of construction time?
It was dependent on a big piece is the amount of time it's going to take them to pump the ponds and haul the sludge away. They have always been going on the assumption.
Wouldn't have been getting very far anyhow. They're going to haul the sludge down to the landfill, I assume?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the weather wouldn't have helped that situation anyhow.
No.
So.
No. And so they're always going on the assumption that the lagoons have never been pumped out. and I didn't know this until recently, found out that the lagoons were pumped in 2012. You might remember that?
Yep.
As part of that project. And so hopefully that shortens our timeline.
They start leaking after we pumped them, you know. That's how it usually does. Take around
well,
the
you
natural
know,
seal.
I think that I don't think that there was any significant leaks detected. Rather, they knew it was a clay liner, and it was impossible for a clay liner to meet the seepage requirements.
Right, right.
So, anyway, that's where we're at, and
so we still have, maybe have an opportunity. We don't know until you get the bids in, see who's the contract, select a contractor, come back in front of us. Right now, we're just tying up loose ends that the grant might expire. And
that's right.
Sending out a notice to them to make sure the money's there when we do the project.
That's right. And we'll. Those are really important questions to the contractor. Do you feel like you can get this done this season? And are we? Do we have sufficient funding to be able to complete the project? Those are the big
questions. And we don't. We would expect DOLA to have no problem with granting this extension, or
as long as we've done our due diligence.
That's correct.
Okay.
And you know, I talked to Mr. Winkler on the phone about this, and this was his recommendation. So
yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Am I up?
No, I got it. Oh. Madam Chair, I move that we approve and authorize your signature on a letter addressed to the State of Colorado Department of Local Affairs to request an extension to the existing grant for a period of 1 year for the Phippsburg Wastewater Treatment Center.
Second.
Other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
I'll send this in.
Got a quick question for you.
Yeah, I was going to say...